Welcome to Cinema Smackdown on CJLO 1690 AM. My name is Michael Brody, and I am joined today by Shane Simmons, a man whose celebrity lookalike is Paul Giamatti. Although lately, people who stop you keep saying, "Gee, Paul, you're looking so much better these days."
Yes, the slightly taller, slightly younger, slightly svelter Paul Giamatti.
It's interesting. That man has let himself go in pre-COVID days in the way that a lot of people did during COVID.
Yeah, well, I wish I had the, I would also say, and considerably poorer to my list of Paul Giamatti comparisons.
You don't know the depth of his gambling debts. How dare you?
One can only hope, but he is on a show called Billionaires, so I'm assuming he must be at least a billionaire.
Billions. Let's get it right.
Oh, billions. Okay. The show, another Paul Giamatti show I don't watch.
It's excellent. It's excellent.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure admittedly, it is. I do like him when he's not in Gunpowder Milkshake or right. Other terrible, terrible action movies.
Right. And remind the listener, the other one you think is a terrible action movie?
What was that? Shoot 'em Up.
Shoot 'em up.
I did not care for.
In which he was young and svelte. It's long enough now.
Yeah, back when he was looking more like me.
I will point out that my favorite, very minor, but delightful Paul Giamatti role is in the movie Morgan, where he has an extended single cameo that steals the movie in its own way. It's kind of a perfect invite a celebrity in to just do one scene sequence. And he's quite good in it.
Yeah, well, as I told you before, he sounds like a perfectly nice guy. I know someone who worked with him on Barney's Version when he was in Montreal shooting it. And it's one of those, he's the star of the movie and here he comes. And he just walks up to these bit part players and says, hi, I'm Paul, which is a level of humble I appreciate.
It's awesome. Yeah, I met Michael Ironside and he, I guess we're just swapping celebrity stories for a moment. He did the same thing. He was like, hello, I'm Michael. And I was like, oh, that's nice. Put out his hand. It was very pleasant.
Yeah, my Michael Ironside story goes a little different, but I'm going to save that for our great eulogy show, which will be any minute now, I'm sure.
We do like to cover the Canadian deaths, don't we?
Yeah, well, in the meantime, I'll also spare you my anecdote about nearly being beaten up by Denzel Washington's bodyguards.
I mean, it's a wonderful story, and I've heard it before, so it's... It really made Denzel seem like a man of the people, didn't it?
Well, it's nothing to do with him, but, when you're shooting, well, I was there for a crew photo of the crappy Discovery show we were shooting next door to the Bone Collector. And all I could say is when a man is surrounded by a phalanx of gigantic bodyguards, don't accidentally nearly bump into him leaving the control room.
It's on you. I agree. I understand.
All my fault.
All right. Well, now that we're done with the celebrity run-ins, let's get on to today's topic. Everybody who tunes in to our show called Cinema Smackdown will be delighted to hear that today it's a book corner. We're getting into books this week.
Books? Who reads?
Precious few people. And for a long while, I was not one of them, but I have recently rekindled my love of reading. And so I'm going to, foist that on the audience. By talking about books I've read, books you've read. And I noticed when I looked through my giant list of books I've been reading or had read in the recent past that there was a lot of film industry crossover. And I thought that that would be interesting to bring up. And we can talk about authors whose work has been translated. Or in my case, I've written down quite a list of people who've worked in film, stuff that we know and love, who have also written novels, some of them very recently. So it's some interesting stuff in here. No conversation about current books would be complete without again bringing up the fact that Quentin Tarantino put out a novel this year.
Or after threatening for years, and it was a threat that I dreaded him ever following through on.
Well, he put out a novelization of his movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood after failing to release novels of Kill Bill, which he had promised, and apparently was even available to pre-order for quite a while before it vanished, and also Django Unchained, another book that he was apparently writing a novelization of that never finished. So
he should be taking a clue from Craig Zoller. And it's like, yeah, there's the movies you make, and there's the novels you write, and they should not be one and the same thing.
What's interesting is you've brought up Zoller, who I was going to bring up in a minute, but Craig Zoller has written approximately 6 or 7 novels, all of which he has screenplays for, none of which have been shot yet. And it's quite interesting. He got, well, I'll get to him in a minute, but he came very close with a recent one, but then the money hasn't happened yet. But back to the Tarantino book. So he wrote what is called a novelization, which is something that was very popular in the 70s and 80s when movies were not available readily after you saw them in the cinema. So you might want to go home and think about Star Wars some more, read the novelization, you know, that kind of thing. And they were big business for quite a long time.
The novelization supposedly written by George Lucas, but actually written by Alan Dean Foster.
I don't believe Alan Dean Foster wrote the first one.
I believe
but someone else did.
Yes. I believe he was the ghostwriter on that. That they just slapped George Lucas's name on it. I have heard
that Lucas did not write the book despite his name being on it. So that's some good trivia. But I thought it was somebody else, like Donald Glut or something. One of these guys.
I think he was a little later.
At any rate, Tarantino wrote a book, and it's written by Tarantino. Make no mistake, no ghostwriter necessary, because it is very poorly written.
Oh, yeah. I hope they kept all his typos.
No,
and misspellings and grammar errors.
They're mostly fixed, except for the ones he demanded they keep because they look better that way, which he did. He did keep a few. There are a few grammatical errors in the book that are consistent, so you know that it was intentional.
Are the pages misnumbered at least?
I wish. So I've crapped on the book a little bit. I will praise it a little bit because I read the book. I got through it. The book contains,
well, chapters, elements you skimmed, I believe.
I will cop to the skipping, but they're very specific skips. The book contains chapters that are from the point of view of Rick Dalton, the Leonardo DiCaprio character from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It also features chapters featuring the Cliff Booth character, who is the Brad Pitt character, who is from his point of view to some degree. But after that, it also features chapters that are essentially novelizations of an episode of a Western TV show. And what is very strange about those is that they are still written in this present tense, third person way, as though someone is describing a script to you rather than you are reading a novelization of it. But the Rick Dalton chapters are okay, if a little self-indulgent. The chapters that featured long descriptions of the plot of a Western were unreadable for me. I couldn't get through them. So I did end up starting to skip those after a while. And there were far too many of them.
Well, they do sound like superfluous side adventures, every bit as important to the plot as Tom Bombadil.
Exactly. However, I will give credit where credit is due. There's something between 30 and 50 pages spread out over the book of Cliff Booth adventures. Little moments, some of them are directly from the movie, but many of them are new, and they are gold. They are great sequences. They're fascinating. They definitely alter your perception of Cliff Booth from, say, is he that guy who might have killed his wife, to a definitive answer to that, and a definitive answer to many, many other people he may have killed. They,
including the time he led that squad to kill Hitler.
Exactly. They do not do the full-on crossover with Inglourious Basterds, but they do make him a World War II action hero. At any rate, all of that to say that the Cliff Booth sequences in the Tarantino book are excellent. I would say if you purchase an e-copy of the book, a nice, what do you call this, like a Kindle copy, use the search function. And so read the chapters that begin with Cliff Booth, and when they are done, use the search to get to the next one and see everything else. It's a 450 page book, and it is mostly filler. So at any rate, it's
how many pages does he spend describing that Sharon Tate film?
A lot. There is also the horrifying realization you have when Quentin Tarantino name drops himself twice in the book. Period name drops of his own life at that point, because he is a very important person, you have to understand. Much like Roman Polanski.
I can't wait for his follow-up stories that take place in his video store clerk era.
They would be more interesting than this. At any rate, I would probably read those. So I know that
I think he has a title. I think it's called Clerks.
Oh, well, no one else is using it
No.
well at the moment.
At least no one important.
No. All right, that's enough on Tarantino. Before we go to break in a couple minutes, I want to mention one other. We need to move on. If we're going to talk books, it's got to be more than one book. I wanted to bring up an author who's had a 40-plus year career, but has only released six novels. I am talking about the very famous, very wealthy, very reclusive Thomas Harris. Now, most people know Thomas Harris, of course, because he created Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal Lecter, includes Clarice Starling and Will Graham and all the interesting characters in that universe. And he wrote two really, really good books, Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs. And then he wrote two contractual obligation novels called Hannibal and Hannibal Rising. Hannibal Rising reads like the Quentin Tarantino novelization of Hannibal Rising. It's poor. It's a poor novel that was, in fact, an adaptation of his own screenplay for a bad movie. So that is not a great read.
No. I like about half of Hannibal.
I grudgingly now, looking back on it, like parts of it. But at the time it was released, I hated it.
And it also
And
has the most ludicrous epilogue of all time,
of all time.
which some people love and adore, and they're so wrong.
It's creepy. It's a very creepy ending.
Is not the ending they went with in the movie for obvious reasons, because you should not put that as the end to your story or the end of anybody's character arc.
Not ever. It is one of the biggest betrayals of a character arc I've ever seen.
There's a reason Jodie Foster turned down that role of returning as Clarice Starling, even though they ultimately rewrote that part. I'm sure she read the book and went, "They did what now?" No.
Well, everyone involved in the original movie, except for Anthony Hopkins, because he will do anything, said they didn't want to come back because of the ultra violence. Now,
Oh, boo-hoo.
whether that's true or not, I mean, there is an ultra violent thing at the end of
Meanwhile,
Hannibal,
Gary
right?
Oldman said, "Oh, ultra violence. Sign me up."
Exactly. Yeah, but keep my name off
They'll
it.
never know it was me under all that makeup anyway.
I will bet you money most people do not know Gary Oldman is in that film.
That's probably true.
I mean,
But most people don't know Gary Oldman's in any film.
exactly. You know, they're not even aware he's in Batman movies. So it's he's managed to stay reasonably anonymous while being a crazy famous person. I was gonna get around to mentioning the newest Thomas Harris novel, but we're gonna run out of time before I can do it any justice. So we will talk about it after the break. Welcome back to Cinema Smackdown on CJLO 1690 AM. I'm Michael Brody. I'm joined by Shane Simmons, and you're listening to Book Corner. This is the week.
For
This
those of you who still read, you suckers.
exactly. This is the week where we cross film with books because I've been reading a lot of books lately. I want to talk to Shane about them, so the rest of you are going to suffer through me talking about books. This particular book, before the break, we were talking a little bit about Thomas Harris, who wrote all of the Hannibal books, because I was trying to lead up to something on purpose. I actually read this book a little bit before my recent return to reading full time. I do a lot of reading now. But Thomas Harris wrote Black Sunday and then four Hannibal novels over 30 years. It's a quite a short career in terms of how much output he's got. And he's a recluse. He never talks. He doesn't give interviews. And out of the blue, about 2 years ago, Thomas Harris announced he was releasing a new novel, not part of any series, just a passion project of something he wanted to write. And the title was announced. The book is called Carrie Mora, which is an odd title and turns out to be the main character's name. And I was very excited to read this book. Because I like Thomas Harris's non-contractual obligation novels.
Yeah,
I'm a
no,
big
he's very
fan.
good. Very diligently researched books as well.
So I picked up his new novel and it was very short. I think I'll just guesstimate. I'm not holding it in my hand. And I'll guesstimate it's about 200 pages. It's not a long book. It is quite a tiny little product. And it's not very good. It's a very, very minor thriller about an illegal immigrant working bad jobs in America and a bunch of very evil men who try to kill her. It's not much more than that. It's also not very inventive. It's just okay. It reads like a very standard paperback trash airport novel, but not a great one. And that was deeply disappointing to me because I thought, well, you're not under any obligation. This could be anything. And when you say his books are really well researched, it's not much in this. How much you need to research. A little bit of scuba diving, maybe.
It'd be weird if this is the one that breaks the trend of he's one of those rare authors who every single book he's written, not that there's a lot, but they've all been adapted to fairly major motion pictures.
This could not be adapted into a major motion picture. This is essentially one of those Lifetime movies, maybe a Netflix film. It is very minor. It's not terrible, but it's just a thriller. It's just a person in danger. Well, you remember the genre, the woman in danger genre of film.
Yes. I've pitched those movies myself because there's quite the market for them.
Yeah. I mean, it's like I said, it's perfectly fine. But when you know it's the guy who wrote Red Dragon, which is not only an incredibly engaging novel plot-wise, it's beautifully written. As of Silence of the Lambs, his next book, Harris started taking more of a screenplay attitude to novel writing. Go back and reread Red Dragon. It is very beautifully written. It's more poetic than anything he wrote afterwards. Sadly, his new novel is not a return to that form, but I guess it's okay.
And the clock is ticking on that career. He's been at it for quite a while. Oh, can't imagine he's a terribly young man anymore.
He must be approaching 80, would be my guess. So as mentioned in the first segment, another author I am very fond of is Mr. S. Craig Zoller, who is well known as a filmmaker. He has produced such masterful films as Bone Tomahawk, Brawl in Cell Block 99, and Dragged Across Concrete, all of which I adore for different reasons. It's funny, I think over time, my favorite has become Brawl in Cell Block 99. What about you?
I would say yes, that is absolutely my favorite Zoller film, although they're all compelling
and they're all very good.
He's certainly put me in the mind to want to read everything he's done, and I will get around to it. I've only read one of his novels so far.
Well, that's the thing. So Zoller, I found out, was a novelist. I went and sought out one of his books. He wrote several books that are not contemporary. He wrote two westerns. One was called Congregation of Jackals, and one is called Wraiths of the Broken Land. Then he wrote a science fiction novel called Corpus Chrome Incorporated. I have not read Corpus Chrome, but I've read everything else. And then he wrote a contemporary book called Mean Business on North Ganson Street, which is an angry police novel.
Yeah, that's the one I've read on your recommendation, and it was excellent. But it's really brutal, really dark.
Brutal, unsurprisingly. And I think to date, my favorite ever reading experience, because it has better dialogue than any other novel I've ever read. It just has so much good, compelling dialogue. I like what he does in movies. I think what he does in books is even better. It's more, it's so perfectly measured in places and very, very clever. And all those characters live and breathe. But for anybody considering jumping onto the Zoller bandwagon, Mean Business on North Ganson Street is a very mean novel. The title says it all.
So yeah, well, I mean, Zoller is not someone you should get into unless you're prepared for dark and harsh and mean and nasty stuff.
Well, I will also highly recommend his novel Wraiths of the Broken Land, which is a brilliant, dark Western. The plot of that book is essentially a gang of cowboys are riding into Mexico to try to rescue two women who've been kidnapped and sold into prostitution. And as dark as that might sound as a basis, the book is much darker than that. So they go to a brothel that is very much hell itself to try to rescue these people. And it's brilliantly described. It is a really rough but really rewarding book. I just want to keep saying his work is really tough. If you are not a strong stomached person, you can't read any of them.
But, yeah. It's a skip.
Yeah, and his most recent novel was called The Slanted Gutter, and it was another contemporary crime novel, and it was an absolute masterpiece, but it's like the roughest 1970s exploitation movie ever made. That's how I would describe it. It is phenomenally successful, but not for the faint of heart. Mm-hmm. I still have not read his science fiction book, and I have not read his strange children's novel, which is oddly titled Hug Chicken Penny, the Panegyric of an Anomalous Child. This man is not interested in generic titles.
No, he is very specific about, I want titles that are absolutely unique and have not been used before.
Well, I kind of can't believe his newest book is called The Slanted Gutter. That's practically like a Louis L'Amour title. It's so dull compared to what he I don't know. Normally says. I mean, to be fair, a slanted gutter is what you would have on a coroner's table or an abattoir.
A slanted gutter is where you arrive at after you've been dragged across concrete.
That's about right. Just to say, when touching on books and people who do film, there's nothing better at this moment in time for me than the S. Craig Zoller work. I'm really, really enjoying it. And
have you read his graphic novel yet?
I have not laid my hands upon it. It is a little expensive for me in terms of price versus page count.
Mm-hmm.
So I keep thinking about it. I'm going to try to find a used copy if I can, because I'm cheap.
Uh-huh.
But I would really like to read it. For those who have been following this far and have any idea who we're talking about at all, Zoller has drawn a comic book. It is a large comic. It's 104 pages. The odd thing about it is he chose to draw it himself. And he has interesting amateurish talents. So his stuff looks like it's work in progress, not a professional artist.
Well, you know, it reminds me of a lot of indie comics that were published back in the day by some of the more obscure publishing houses.
Yeah. And his publishing,
it's not house, Marvel and DC stuff.
I went and had a look at them recently. I can't remember what they're called, but they're like Gravity Rainbow or something along those lines. And every comic or graphic novel they've published has the same level of artwork. So they have a real particular type. I would call
it. Yeah, but I mean, you know, we both came up reading a lot of stuff out of, you know, Kitchen Sink or Fantagraphics or, you know, Slave Labor published some of those hacks.
True.
Including myself. So, yeah, you know, it's a particular type of alternative comic book.
True. For a while there, the entire independent comic book industry was you and Evan Dorkin.
Oh, and Jonan Vasquez.
There you go. Perfect. All right, so that's S. Craig Zoller. Well worth searching out.
We all turned into TV hacks too. That's funny.
Yeah. Evan Dorkin, I recently listened to an interview with him. He did not turn into a successful TV hack. He was bemoaning how little television work he's gotten and how no money he has and how the industry has abandoned him. He was not a happy man in this interview.
He's never been a happy man. He's hilarious. Like, personally, one of the funniest people I've ever met.
Oh, that's over. But,
yeah, well, he's always been an extremely angry man. He's probably the only person I've met who's angrier than I am.
I mean, that's saying something.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm a ball of internalized rage.
You can practically power a small city on your rage alone. Just get the
now. See, Evan, by comparison, he externalizes a lot of his rage, not in violent sort of ways, but in expressive rants of comedic masterwork.
Oh, here's the problem. Evan Dorkin has not yet started writing novels, so we're not allowed to talk about him today.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to jump back and mention somebody just of note that there have been a few film adaptations of his work, and that would be Gregory MacDonald. Now, I mostly bring this up because Gregory MacDonald is the creator of Fletch, which became a Chevy Chase movie in the 80s and a second Chevy Chase movie in the late 80s.
Which, you know, considering there was, you know, a dozen Fletch novels or so at the time, they had to make a sequel that was based on none of them.
Yeah, that was strange. And it's also nothing. The first movie has a resemblance to the books. Not 100%, but it's a resemblance. And the second movie does not.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an odd, broad Chevy Chase comedy mystery. It's not terrible, but it doesn't feel anything like MacDonald's work. It feels like Chevy Chase's work.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people love the original Fletch movie. I'm a big fan of the Fletch novel and subsequent novels as well, but the first one in the series in particular. And the movie never did it for me because There's a lot of Hollywoodisms to it, and Fletch is one of those characters who lies constantly to people in order to get information out of them. So he's constantly introducing himself as various people he is not. And the Hollywood solution of that was to have him in dumb disguises constantly, which is
there's a little too much
irritating to me.
Well, I saw the movie before I read the books. It was my gateway, you know, into Gregory MacDonald. So I can't blame the movie. And I kind of liked it, especially as a child or a young man. And I guess the point is, Fletch was a property that's been lingering for 30 plus years and almost 40 at this point. And they've been trying to make another Fletch movie every 2 years ever since then. For a really long time, it was going to be a Kevin Smith movie. First, it was with multiple leads. So first it was going to be Kevin Smith's Fletch One. That's one of the novels with Jason Lee, which I would have liked. I would have enjoyed that film.
Well, at the time, Jason Lee is fine. However, keeping Kevin Smith's grubby hack hands off of the Fletch property. Thank God.
But a couple of years later, it was still in development with him, and it was going to be Kevin Smith's Fletch starring Zach Braff. That also didn't happen. Later on, Jason Sudeikis became entangled in the possibility of starring as Fletch.
Yeah, him I think it would be excellent casting.
He'd be perfect, but that's never going to happen now. And after decades of rumor after rumor or deal that fell through with Fletch, they've just started rolling cameras on a Fletch movie. We're getting one next year, and it stars John Hamm, who I don't like in this role. I mean, as an announcement, it doesn't work for me.
Yeah, depends on what era of Fletch's career it is as well, because right. He's a pretty young guy in the early stories.
Exactly, and Hamm's in his 50s now. I'm not saying no, I hope he wins me over. John Hamm does have the ability to win me over, so maybe.
Right.
You know, I will argue this to the death. John Hamm is the protagonist of Baby Driver. He's certainly the only character I care about by the end of the film.
Right, true.
Because everybody else failed for me in terms of characterization. He's the only one I'm like, no, I'm on his side. I want him to win.
My only hope is that if they're readapting the original Fletch novel, that they get the ending right this time, because the ending of Fletch is one of my all-time favorite novel endings, and they completely pissed it away in the movie with Chevy Chase. As entertaining as that film is, it's a brilliant end that they just didn't bother to do.
Well, we talked earlier about the work of the Thomas Harris. They readapted Red Dragon. That's been made into two movies. The first movie was Manhunter. Totally different ending to the book.
And that's another fantastic book ending as well.
Yeah, but I really loved how Manhunter worked, and it worked perfectly. And admittedly, when you read the novel, you go, wow, what a great ending of this novel. It's going to be even better if they shot that ending. Well, they did shoot that ending for the, I don't know, 2005 remake with Edward Norton and Anthony Hopkins, and it is not good. It is not good in that movie. It feels obvious. It's not awesome.
Need I point out it's a Brett Ratner film, so there's a limit to how good that film was ever going to be good.
That man's untouchable. In fact, his work, his career is so untouchable, he's never going to get hired again.
That's how you prove that.
Add
him to the pile of Me Too'd to death celebrity directors.
I will remind the listener you're tuned into CJLO 1690 AM. I'm Michael Brody. I'm joined by Shane Simmons. Shane, you're an author, and we're talking about books. Give us a title of a book you've written.
An author? Who writes books now? You got to be a complete sucker to do that. No one reads.
Also, didn't you write a book about Hollywood?
I did, of sorts. Mm-hmm. I wrote Sex Tape, which was a screenplay I had in development for a while, legitimately. And that's a whole episode to talk about that excursion into futility, largely because of our own government and its approach to backing Canadian film.
Tune in next week when we do an entire episode of Shane's screenplay Sex Tape.
I will say it was worth it just for me to attend a 4-day conference where I had to walk around with a lanyard and an ID card on it that said Shane Simmons sex tape.
Perfect. That can be found in the Amazon bookstore, can't it?
Yes, it is. It is a novel now, and there will be a sequel to it, I promise, because I do love my detective character, Sid Volk, and I have a number of tawdry Hollywood-related stories I would like to do with him.
Yeah, but now we know he doesn't die. You've ruined this novel for all of the people who haven't tried it
yet. Yeah, I think the levity of the novel will be apparent that this is not a Craig Zoller book.
Well, it could also be a posthumous series. He could be dead at the beginning, and every he could be a ghost detective.
Well, increasingly, that series is becoming a period piece. So, because the first book takes place specifically around, I think it's 2008. And I'm writing sequels to this, I'm not going to jump 10 years.
I think if you wanted to make sex tape relevant these days, it would have to be about something someone stole from the cloud.
Mm. Yeah, well, the whole point of sex tape is that... the world hadn't gone digital enough yet for a VHS. It's about trying to find a celebrity sex tape before someone digitizes it.
There you go.
And it's an old sex tape dating back from the VHS days.
All right. Well, we've shilled for you long enough. I've gotten back into writing, so I might be shilling for myself again sometime in the near future if I make it into a couple of anthologies that I have been submitting to. But we'll save that for when I actually.
Well, I'm telling you right on. Yeah, they're waiting for you to come up with enough short stories to do a collection.
Yeah, it's in the works. It's in the works. We'll see how much material I can cobble together or steal. copyright free material is good, right?
Yeah, you know, just modernize the English a little bit.
I'll just fill up the back pages with some Arthur Conan Doyle stories.
Yeah, just nothing from that last Canada, right? Nothing from that last collection, or the family will be up your ass.
I'll keep in mind. All right, let's get back to talking about the books and the Hollywood industry related to books. We just talked about Gregory MacDonald. You yourself, Shane, I'm going to go ahead and say decades, had a favorite author who was deeply connected to the film industry. And you and I had many, many conversations about the career of Michael Crichton.
Michael Crichton, yes.
So tell us a little bit about Crichton and his highlights and lowlights, whatever you've got.
Well, Crichton was an interesting guy because he studied to be and was a doctor. And he was doing novels on the side, and he was publishing them under different pen names because... it was considered even in the late 60s to be kind of a disgraceful thing for a doctor to be engaged in writing these pulpy, his early stuff is sort of thriller, mystery, adventure type stories. Yeah. And then
he wrote under Jeffrey something.
He wrote under John Lang. He wrote under Jeffrey Hudson.
Yeah. And I read a Jeffrey Hudson a lot.
Third name as well. Yeah. The Jeffrey Hudson one was A Case of Need, which was appropriately enough, a hospital-based thriller. Yep,
that's the one I read.
And then by the time he wrote The Andromeda Strain, which came out in 1969, he decided, screw it, I'm a novelist, I'm not a doctor. And that was the first book that was actually published under his real name. And it was an explosive bestseller.
I mean, it did lay the groundwork for him to work with Gene Simmons down the line.
Yeah, well, he also did a fair amount of directing himself.
It's kind of fascinating. He wrote books, he wrote movies, and he directed movies, and not all of the movies he directed, he wrote. He actually directed a few films written by other people, which is very strange.
Yeah, and yet they are sort of within his wheelhouse of cautionary techno thrillers, which is what his career ultimately became.
Not his Burt Reynolds movie, though. That one is...
Which was the Burt Reynolds one?
I don't have the title off the top of my head, but while you talk, I will look it up again. He did direct Burt Reynolds' crime thriller. And it's perfectly fine. It is a likable enough movie, but it's not really a Burt Reynolds movie. A Michael Crichton movie.
Now, well, Crichton, kind of like Thomas Harris, was one of those best-selling authors who just everything he wrote got made into a major motion picture. There's a few exceptions, but they're pretty rare. And following his death quite a few years ago now, they went through a spate of basically publishing every post-it note he ever affixed to the back of his computer, because books with the Michael Crichton brand name on them keep coming out, but it's other authors finishing up the work, probably keeping to the Crichton formula, which is a very specific, if you look at the Andromeda Strain, he stumbled across this amazing formula where a small group of experts from diverse fields are brought together to solve a very big problem. And just when you think they might get a handle on it, the deadline is narrowed even more. And that kind of follows his formula for almost everything else he's done, including, of course, Jurassic Park.
There you go. His Burt Reynolds movie was called Physical Evidence. It started Burt Reynolds and Teresa Russell and Ned Beatty. The recently passed Ned Beatty.
Okay.
And I remember,
and recently passed Burt Reynolds.
And just about everybody in this. I remember quite enjoying it. My recollection of it is rather vague, but I remember it being a very solid, likable 1989 thriller. It just seems like in 1989, why was Michael Crichton directing trashy Burt Reynolds thrillers?
That's weird. I haven't seen that one. I've seen most of his other work, but
it was written by a gentleman named Bill Phillips, so not connected at all.
Well, I guess they made him an offer that was a big pile of cash, and he said, sure. If you want to see the best example of the Michael Crichton writing, adapting himself, and directing, of course, it's The Great Train Robbery with Sean Connery and Donald Sutherland, which, even though it's a Victorian period piece, it follows that formula I mentioned to a T. And obviously, Crichton liked working with Connery so much that if you look at all his subsequent books, every single one he publishes, there's a character that is clearly designed to be, hey, cast Sean Connery for this.
Right.
And they kept ignoring that suggestion until Red Dawn, where they did, when they adapted the film, they did bring on Sean Connery in the most screaming from the rooftops version of, please cast Sean Connery in this part.
It's called Red Sun, by the way.
Red Sun? That's
quite right.
Completely different film.
As anyone listening to this show has maybe noticed, I do the exact same thing constantly. So I'm not really one to throw stones. I just want to get it on the
road. No, as long as we're there to catch each other when we fall off the trapeze.
Yeah, it's pretty constant. I'm no flying Grayson.
Yeah, but we are like the Graysons, working without a net.
There you go. Personal favorite Michael Crichton novel?
I will say that my personal favorite, which is one of the worst film adaptations, is Congo.
Mm-hmm.
Congo was one that I knew a bunch of people who were reading at the same time, even though it was a older book by the time we were all collectively reading it, but we would call each other on the phone and joke that, the name of the book was actually Congo, It's Amazing, because everyone would give that recommendation to each other. Have you read Congo? It's amazing.
It's a slightly tough read now because it's very technocentric, and all of the technology in it is, it feels like
it is dated. Yes.
Yeah. It's so dated. And the thing is, those kind of books are a lot of fun to read. I've read a couple of novels by Trevanian. He's a European author who just published under one name, Trevanian. And he did technology in his books in the early 70s. And it's like this incredible technology of watching film in a camera that you could rewind. And he goes into excruciating detail of how you could roll the film back without destroying it. And it's kind of great. But, I mean, it was probably dated about an hour after the book was published. Similarly, the electronics that are described in Congo are outrageously, hilariously.
Yeah, it's all early computer stuff.
Exactly. But it's
although I will also highly recommend, even though it's a really obvious choice, but the Jurassic Park novel is great to the point where I don't like the film very much, because the film has about 5% of the intelligence that the book has.
But it's got Richard Attenborough being all cute.
I like Richard Attenborough a lot, but I always found the Jurassic Park movie lacking in that it was just, well, we could do really convincing dinosaurs on film finally. And they forgot to bring any of the meat of the book to the screen.
There you go.
And have continued to do so through many sequels.
Understood. All right. Well, we have just a couple minutes left, so I'm going to quickly hit on the guy I just mentioned, Trevanian. Now, Trevanian never worked in film, but many of his movies were, one of his books, many of his books were adapted, or at least a couple were. Famously, the book The Iger Sanction was adapted.
Oh, okay.
Was, not a great movie starring Clint Eastwood. No. But a pretty great novel. The Iger Sanction is a really good book about an assassin who's in the film played by Clint Eastwood. And some jobs he had to do. The sanction is the assassination part. That's why it's called that.
Yeah, but as far as mountain climbing assassin films go, you would hope it would be great. It just feels like it should be great, and the film is not.
It has some long scenes of people climbing, unfortunately. I will say this, though. If you are at all inclined to read Trevanian, Iger Sanction is an excellent novel, but an even better novel is a sequel called The Lew Sanction. While the Iger referred to a mountaintop, right? The Iger something. The Lew literally refers to a bathroom. It's The Lew Sanction. It's about getting a high.
So it's about Clint Eastwood scaling a bathroom to kill someone?
It's about murdering someone in a bathroom. And it is a wonderful novel. There is no film adaptation of it, but even today I'd love to see one. Back to Cinema Smackdown on CJLO 1690 AM. This week, Book Corner. We're talking books. I wasn't sure if we were going to get around to books that were not film related, but we're not. We don't have that much time. So it's all books that have something to do with the film industry, writers that have had their work adapted or work in both industries. Speaking of people who work in both industries of books, I'm going to bring up a guy I just found out wrote a book. I was completely unaware of this until about 24 hours ago, and I heard an interview and realized, oh my God, you're writing books now? Brian De Palma is writing novels.
Oh my God, really?
I think that has a lot to do with the fact that no one will let him make movies anymore.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in book form, how is he going to rip off Hitchcock?
Well, I can't speak for certain as to what his level of competency is in terms of ripoffs, but I can say that I got a copy of his book in my hand and was not thrilled with it because the book is called, one sec, what is it called? It is called Are Snakes Necessary? Which apparently is an Einstein quote or something.
Okay.
It was some philosophical concept. So Brian De Palma wrote a book called Are Snakes Necessary? I read a page. This book is written in third person present tense.
Okay.
And it is not good. It's not good at all. It's
well, third person present tense doesn't necessarily kill a book, but
oh, this did. It is very explain to you, the reader, what is going on in a very condescending tone. It reads like a really bad screenplay that is delving into characters' thoughts. Imagine screenplay descriptions, but telling you, and at this moment, the politician was thinking this. It's not awesome.
Okay.
I will say that as far as third person present tense goes, Chuck Palahniuk does it on a genius level, and pretty much no one else does. I don't know about you. I've written a couple of stories in third person present tense, but I have tried as hard as possible to keep them very simple because I don't want to be a jerk about it. And De Palma has no such issue. he's delighted at the thought of, I believe the Tarantino novel, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, is also written in third person present tense, except the third person is Quentin Tarantino in his own voice. And it is very clear he is the person talking at you. Not my favorite either.
Well, that's that's Tarantino all over. He talks at people.
So I didn't read the De Palma book, so I don't have any real comment about it, except that it exists. Two more authors.
Was it a one page and give up type of situation? Or
it was a one page just to see. I absolutely hated the tone but it wasn't necessarily a give up. I'll let you know if I ever go back to it. I do like Brian De Palma's work, so I mean some of it. I like
I can't quite remember the last film he made that I enjoyed, but
yeah, you have to go
Have to go back decades at this point.
Yeah. It's an 80s or early 90s time to I mean, I obviously enjoyed The Untouchables, which isn't exactly a De Palma film, although his visual style is all over it.
Yeah, but, yeah. As well as his plagiarism movie. Style. But
the true De Palma movies, though, are more interesting, like Body Double. And
yeah, I like the trashier stuff, really.
I forget. I mean, are you a hater of Blowout? Because I'm a lover
of Blowout. No, but Blowout never did it for me in the same way that some of his other films did. Because I do like Body Double a lot.
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. Body Double.
It's sleazy as hell, but it's fun.
Exactly. But yeah, it is a very fun, it's like the most ridiculous a Hitchcock movie could possibly be, but yeah. Then it goes further than that. So it's pretty outrageous. So that was the De Palma one. I just want to mention a couple of pretty famous film writers who have recently released novels that are all, I haven't read any of them, but they're very interesting. So David Koepp recently released a novel. David Koepp was the screenwriter of Jurassic Park, among many, many, many films. My favorite of his work is probably Stir of Echoes, which he also directed. He did
although he was adapting Richard Matheson. And yes, you really can't go wrong source material there.
Except I read the novel.
And oh, yeah.
Everything that's good in that movie comes from David Koepp.
Oh, really? Okay, because that's a Matheson novel I have not read. Of course, I'm a big fan of I Am Legend. Yes. Not the various adaptations of it, because most of them are not good, but exactly. The original novel is fantastic.
I will say there's nothing wrong with the novel, Stir of Echoes, but very little of what is good in the movie comes from that novel. Very, very little. It is not the same plot structure at all. Neither is it, let's call it superpowers. Neither is it the same superpowers exactly. Kept it an interesting job of changing that around. So he's gotten into the novel writing business. He wrote a book in 2019 called Cold Storage. I haven't read it yet, so it's just a comment that it exists. Jumping into the book industry, Gregory Whidden, who wrote Highlander, he put out a book in 2013 called Blood Makes Noise. again,
sure,
read
that
it.
Wasn't a Zoller title.
Yeah. maybe it would be Splatter Makes Noise if he wrote it. Another gentleman who whose work I really, really like, screenwriter and TV writer, is Scott Frank. Scott Frank, who burst onto the scene for me with Dead Again, which is a film I absolutely love screenplay-wise. Scott Frank recently did everyone's favorite pandemic Netflix show, Queen's Gambit. That's the title.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
That's the title? Queen's Gambit?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so generic. He wrote and directed all of that based on a novel. It was a wonderful 7-hour adaptation. And most people who've seen it say the same thing. It's not a TV show. That was a 7-hour movie. But Scott Frank jumped into the novel writing business in 2016, possibly during a lull in his career because he had some quieter points. And Scott Frank's book is called Shaker. I think it's about a crime story that takes place during an earthquake, something along those lines. Scott Frank also, he became a film director as well. And I'm a really, really big fan of his Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie with Jeff Daniels. What the hell is that movie called? You know the one I'm talking about.
I'm not sure.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt is essentially a young man on the spectrum who is lured into
The Lookout. The Lookout. Yeah, yeah. Lookout.
That's the one. I love that film. That's pure Scott Frank. And he does a lot of adaptations, much like David Koepp. They're actually kind of interchangeable in the way they both do adaptations a lot of the time. Interesting writers, both of them. I much prefer their originals. One more guy who does a lot of TV and film work is Noah Hawley. And Noah Hawley has been writing novels for almost 20 years. He's got a lot of material out there, but he's the creator of the Fargo television show and has written the lion's share of those episodes. Hawley is a very interesting writer. I have not gotten to his books yet, but it is on my to-do list.
Yeah, no, that would be interesting. I'll listen to you for any recommendations on that front in particular. Yeah.
He's got more than 6 books, so it's there's something to look into there.
It's almost like if you're a screenwriter in Hollywood, you hate the process so much that it drives you into novels.
I don't know why you'd think that.
I don't know why either.
It's a strange, it's a conundrum. One more guy who writes books now because Hollywood won't let him work anymore, and it's understandable why, is a horror creator that you and I both like quite a bit named Eric Red. Eric Red has been writing novels for about 15 years, not doing anything else either.
Well, it's not like he can get work either, anywhere else.
So. I thought he'd written two or three, but he is on to, let me count them quickly. 11. He's on to his 11th book.
Wow.
So he is really cranking them out. Many of them are Westerns, including a werewolf Western called The Guns of Santa Sangre, which sounds hilarious. I think that's the werewolf one. I have a few of these. I have not gotten to them yet. He also seems to have a very interesting highway thriller book called White Knuckle, which really just looks like an Eric Red movie.
Right.
But he's got
it's almost like they stopped making his sort of trash exploitation films in the 80s. So he just is writing books that are trash exploitation 1980s films.
Yeah. I guess I'll save that one.
I'm all for that.
We're running out of time and I was going to mention another author, but an author I can actually expound on. So I guess I'll save him if we do another episode of this.
Part one of our 50 part series
on books. Get ready for more books, people. Do you have anything else that you'd like to bring up, Shane, in the book department?
Oh, no, but I do want to do a future episode about nothing but cozy mysteries about detectives and their pets solving crimes.
I mean,
I can't believe this isn't a major movie genre at this point.
You've got to write one of those first, and I am all for it. I will support the writing of this book. I will Patreon that book.
Well,
you write a cozy mystery novel, I will give you a couple bucks a month towards your cat mystery.
I got to come up with a bit more interesting animal than cat. It has to be like an armadillo or something.
Lemur. It'd be a comfort animal. Lemur.
Those little primate opposable thumbs will be very handy solving that mystery.
I'm looking forward to it. I think you can do it. Although I have a feeling you'd kill the animal off mid-story and we'd have a Turner and Hooch situation on our hands.
No, yeah, well, I'd pull the Raiders of the Lost Ark with the poison dates. Get rid of that little monkey bastard.
Wow, would Spielberg never let that happen in a movie today?
Yeah, remember when Spielberg had balls?
Yeah, I've seen him bend over backwards to save anything or anyone remotely cute in his films. There's no more tragedy in a Spielberg movie, I guess, with the exception of Munich, where he does allow a very pretty girl to die, which seemed impossible in a Spielberg movie.
Well. I have a lot of criticisms of Munich, including probably the most uncomfortable sex scene anyone's ever shot.
Yeah, it was kind of the point, though.
Yeah, but I don't know. I just found it perversely funny as opposed to tragic.
Well, unfortunately, of the last 30 years of Spielberg movies, it's probably my favorite. It's pretty close, and it is not a perfect film. It's messy. Munich is not a masterpiece, but it's still the one that I walked away from with the most respect for him for having made. It's a toss-up, of course, between that and Ready Player One.
Oh, God.
It takes...
The movie just, he directed one weekend and then turned it over to a bunch of computer people.
Yeah. It takes not just skill, but nobility to get that movie done. There's about 25 minutes of full live action that is clearly directed by a very bored Steven Spielberg.
It seemed directed with every bit of the same enthusiasm that George Lucas directed The Phantom Menace.
Oh, dear.
From a couch.
The ultimate diss. You pulled a Phantom Menace. Ooh, the horror. Have you heard this rumor that the gentleman who played Jar Jar Binks is lobbying for the role of a black Superman at the moment?
With that resume, how can he fail?
How could he fail? I think they should just go ahead and get Obama to play Superman. That would be kind of a great movie. That would be kind of a great movie, I think. I think they should do it. Go ahead, give me your argument.
Slightly old for the part.
Come on. You can do better than that.
I don't want to hear Superman pontificating and going every 2 seconds.
All right, well, on those hateful words against Obama.
Against the most beloved president of the last
century.
This century,
the last literal 100 years.
And boy, has the competition been sparse.